This is Nightly Business Report with Tyler Matheson and Sue Herrera.
Tailspin. Oil prices enter a bear market, trading 20% below their most recent peak. And there's a chance the decline could deepen.
Fashion forward. Amazon has already changed the way we shop, and now it's sending a chill through the retail sector again.
Pricey packages. Why your holiday shopping just got a little bit more expensive. Those stories and more tonight on Nightly Business Report for Tuesday, June 20th. And good evening, everyone. I'm Contessa Brewer in for Sue Herrera.
And I'm Bill Griffith in tonight for Tyler Matheson. It is official now. Oil prices have fallen into bear market territory. That means that they are more than 20% below their most recent peak, which was reached in January, marking the lowest settlement price for oil this year. Domestic crude fell by 2% today, closed around $43 a barrel. The reason for the decline is a familiar one. There's simply too much crude on the market and not enough demand. The world's biggest oil producers tried to fix the problem, but as Jackie DeAngelis tells us now, the fix is showing some cracks.
Crude oil lower again on concerns about oversupply, which is not what's supposed to be happening right now. OPEC is committed to cutting output this year, but some member countries like Libya and Nigeria are cheating.
I think there's a couple different reasons for oil's decline, and they kind of all culminated in a perfect storm. First was the belief that OPEC didn't have the same control over the oil market that they once did. So when they agreed to production cuts, the market started to decline as well. Then I think the market believed that the OPEC members were beginning to become frustrated with that situation, and that exacerbated the move lower. And we've talked about it for years, supply, supply, supply. There's a ton of supply still. So right now I think there's everybody is talking about the bearish reasons for crude to go lower. So I'm starting to worry about this a little bit now because it seems like everyone's on one side of the boat.
Adding to the pressure, demand is not rising to meet the excess supply, and it should be this time of year. Over 100-degree temperatures on parts of the West Coast combined with continued rain on the East Coast, keeping travelers at home. Finally, North American production, the U.S. and Canada, both forecasted to rise significantly. The U.S. could produce a record 10 million barrels a day by next year, according to government data. And IHS Markit says Canada could ramp up to 3 million barrels a day in the next 2 years. So the question now, how low can we go?
I definitely think the 30s are a possibility medium term. I think before that happens, we're due for a bounce. Like I said before, I think that people are positioned short quite a bit, and I think we could get a bounce from the 42.5 area up towards 48. At that point in time, I think we resume the trend lower, and that leg lower gets us into the 30s for sure, in my opinion, 38, 37.
4th of July is the peak of the summer driving season, now only 2 weeks away. Without the seasonal boost for crude prices, some say it could be a while before we see 50 again. For Nightly Business Report, I'm Jackie DeAngelis.
And joining us now to talk more about oil, where he sees prices head, is John Kilduff. He's the founding partner of Again Capital. We just heard the trader there talking about mid-30s. What's your take?
I think that's right, although I don't necessarily agree with this trip back up to $48 a barrel. The chickens have really come home to roost here for OPEC and Russia, who did come together, as was mentioned, in November to try to fix this market. Fact of the matter is they've done too little in not enough amount of time. And the problem they're having now is that they did not account on two big countries coming back online with their oil production, that being the country of Nigeria and the country of Libya, who are now dumping about 2 million barrels a day of oil on the market that was not planned for.
And, John, what role did the U.S. producers play in all of this? I mean, in the last few months, we've seen more and more of them come back online again. That's even more supply.
That's even more supply, Bill, and there's a wave of that oil yet to come. The biggest uptick in production so far this year, really, most of it has come, believe it or not, from long-planned projects in the Gulf of Mexico. Even though the shale producers get all the credit and all the glory like a wide receiver on a football team, the heavy lifting and tackling has been done in the Gulf. And so we're still going to, we have yet to cash in on, if you will, the super high rise in the U.S. rig count that's going to bring us a lot more oil. I think we get to 10 million barrels per day before the end of the year.
And one thing that we haven't mentioned is all the upheaval in the Middle East. There's been this diplomatic back and forth with Saudi Arabia and some of its neighbors, the disturbances in Syria. How do you factor those issues into what happens with oil?
I have to say that that is a potential booby trap, for lack of a better word, for the consensus view or my view that prices go to 38. This is a powerful bear market that we're able to shake off the seeming troubles that are there. The rhetoric is as hot as I've ever seen it in my career. You have Saudi Arabia and Iran really at each other's throats, like I think like never before. And what you're hearing about the situation in Syria and Qatar leaves this thing at a real opportunity to blow wide open. We had Iran and China doing naval exercises in the Strait of Hormuz, where 40% of the world's oil transits through. So just this weekend. So again, there is definite concern about that situation.
John Kilduff with, again, Capital. John, so great of you to join us. Thanks.
Thank you, Contessa.
Meanwhile, the decline in oil prices may be one of the reasons why inflation remains relatively low right now. Today, the president of the Chicago Federal Reserve said he is concerned about the soft inflation data and that it may be best if the central bank waits until year end to decide whether to raise interest rates yet again.
I have voted with the committee on the rate increases so far, and that's in part because I think that the fundamentals for the economy are good. I think that the unemployment rate falling to 4.3 is good. I think it's likely that we will see more inflationary pressures, but I'm nervous. So I think that our current stance of policy, even though we've increased the funds rate by 100 basis points from the floor, I think it's still accommodating. And so I think up to this point, I think that we can still expect that inflation will go up to 2%.
As he suggested, Mr. Evans is a voting member of the Fed's policy committee right now, and he added that some of the challenges in getting inflation to that 2% target are global competition and new technology.
The fall in oil prices dragged energy stocks lower, including two Dow components, ExxonMobil and Chevron, and that in turn weighed on the broader market, with the Dow and the S&P 500 retreating from all-time highs. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 61 points to 21,467. The NASDAQ was off 50, and the S&P 500 dropped 16.
And the retail sector was also weak today. This after Amazon took yet another swing at the industry that it's already been reshaping. The online company is now launching a new clothing delivery service. The concern for retailers is that this new competitor will lead to lower prices and narrower margins, something the industry is already struggling with. Bob Pisani has more for us tonight.
Today it was retail stocks that took a dive as the Amazon juggernaut rolled on. Amazon rolled out Amazon Wardrobe, where they attempted to tackle some of the biggest problems with buying clothes. The time it takes to shop, for example, and the hassle of finding the size that's right for you and returning stuff you don't want. Judging by the market's reaction, it looks like the street believes Amazon has advanced the ball considerably. Big retail names like Nordstrom, JCPenney, Chico's, and discounters like Ross Stores, all down 3 to 8% or more. That's a lot. It's a simple idea. Try before you buy, and you only pay for what you keep. So you pick out three items or more, you get shipping for free, and you have 7 days to try the stuff on and decide what you keep. Simple idea. The real genius is the return policy. You get 10% off if you keep three or four items. You get 20% off if you keep five or more. The more you keep, the more you save. You dump the rest in the box and you leave it at your doorstep. You don't even need to be home when they come by to pick it up for free. In theory, now, this is not a retail apocalypse, since it appears Amazon will support brands that are outside Amazon's private label, including, for example, Calvin Klein, Adidas, Hugo Boss, and some others. Well, that may be true, but the market didn't act that way. For example, every large shoemaker, which theoretically could also sell through Amazon, was down 2 to 3%, including Deckers and Skechers and Steve Madden. Tough day. For Nightly Business Report, I'm Bob Pisani at the New York Stock Exchange.
So from shoes to food, Amazon certainly is reshaping how the retail industry works, and it may be about to do the same for the economy as a whole, as some economists now believe that this deal with Whole Foods could push down food prices and therefore inflation. Jack McIntyre is fixed income portfolio strategist at Brandywine Global. He joins us tonight to talk about that. What do you think, Jack? I mean, we know that competition is good. It keeps prices lower. Technology's bringing prices lower. What about this, the impact it'll have on the food business?
So, you know, I agree. I mean, you're marrying, and you've alluded to it, competition and technology. I mean, those two things are already disinflationary, deflationary. The fact that you're bringing them both together, to me, is just planting the seeds that we are in secular disinflationary pressures. And that's great if you're a bond investor.
How much of this, Jack, really has to do with Amazon getting into the grocery business or getting into the wardrobe business in ways that they're not already?
Yeah, so I think, again, I kind of alluded to it. So you think about the competitive nature of what they're doing, and you're introducing a behemoth into different sectors. And again, this is just, we don't know 10 years from now how this is going to ultimately sort of play out. But anytime you introduce, a major competitor that's backed by technological advances, it is going to ultimately lead to greater competition. And that's going to be, see lower prices or better quality. In this case, I think you're going to see both of those.
Hmm. You're the fixed income guy, and there's a conundrum in the Treasury markets right now. Yields have been hovering near year lows lately, even as the economy continues to grow. Is it because you think the markets sense this lower inflation that the Fed's wringing its hands over right now?
Yeah, I agree. So if you look at the yield curve, it's been flattening. So that tells you that the market's not worried about inflationary pressures. I actually think we're a little bit in the sweet spot right now because there is decent economic growth. It's just that that growth is not inflationary. So it's an environment where I think equities can do well. Certainly bonds can continue to do well because inflation is certainly going to be contained. And this whole idea of Amazon buying Whole Foods just reinforces that.
Well, is there a risk of deflation that comes along with deflation if you're gaming it out and looking, say, 10 years in the future?
No, I don't. Because, I think the model that sort of Amazon is taking, it reminds me a little bit of what China is trying to do. They go in, they focus on get market share, worry less about profits, and then eventually when they sort of, you'll see a lot of their competition go away, they'll be in a position to actually start raising prices, focus on profits, increasing their profit margin, and that ultimately could be inflationary. But again, that's probably not until 10 years down the road.
Very, very interesting. Jack McIntyre with Brandywine Global. Good to see you. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Good to see you. Thank you.
Still ahead, there's one place where prices soon will rise, and though it's only June, holiday shoppers should pay some close attention. One of the world's biggest index providers will add Chinese equities to its global emerging markets benchmark beginning next year. Now, we told you yesterday it was being considered. MSCI's decision to add some shares to the widely tracked index could move hundreds of billions of dollars of funds from asset managers and pension funds to mainland China's equity markets over the next decade. Bill.
Well, a record quarter for FedEx. The package delivery company reported higher than expected profit and higher sales in its ground and freight delivery business units today. FedEx has been spending billions of dollars to upgrade its networks to handle the rise in package delivery volumes. And investors may feel that it has paid off. They sent the stock initially higher in late day trade tonight.
And if you do a lot of your holiday shopping online, it may cost you a bit more. Morgan Brennan tells us what UPS is doing to keep up with the growing number of packages that need to be delivered.
Online shopping could become more expensive. For the first time ever, UPS is adding an extra charge to packages shipped during the busiest weeks of the holiday season. A 27-cent fee will be levied on ground deliveries destined for residential doorsteps, shipped in the days around Black Friday and the week leading up to Christmas. And charges will also apply to some next-day air and oversized shipments. The move comes as UPS, FedEx, and the U.S. Postal Service have scrambled to keep pace with e-commerce growth, growth that's pushed up costs and made it harder to make money, especially during the peak season when more planes, trucks, and workers are needed for the infrastructure to keep up with demand. UPS CEO David Abney discussed those challenges in an interview just last month.
The surge pricing is just making sure that during that time of year, when certain customers give us a lot more packages, If it drives our costs, we simply want to be compensated for that cost.
UPS has also previously said it may charge some retail customers for missed forecasts, meaning the packages they expected to ship but never actually did. It all translates to higher shipping costs for companies trying to capitalize on e-commerce, even Amazon.
When you have a costs are going up and people are willing to pay for it, you're going to find marketplace participants raising price. And I would point out that last year, UPS did what I would call a shadow increase, in that they announced in December that in order to get two-day service, you had to pay for next-day service. And they did a bit of a shadow surge charge last year. This year, they're just being more transparent about it, and I would expect FedEx to follow.
The move by UPS will force retailers like Walmart, Macy's, and Target to decide whether to eat those costs or raise shipping prices for consumers, a move seen as rather risky in the age of Amazon Prime.
As we reach these capacity maximums, you know, we're seeing the post office raise rates, we're seeing UPS implement a peak surcharge. I think that just says in the future, we're going to have to decide, do we want to pick up that package at a Whole Foods or a Walgreens location, or do we pay for the luxury of having it delivered right to our doorstep?
The other alternative, divert business to another shipping firm, like the U.S. Postal Service, which is less likely to follow suit with extra charges of its own. For Nightly Business Report, I'm Morgan Brennan.
Boeing raises its long-term delivery forecast, and that's where we begin tonight's Market Focus. The aircraft maker said that it expects to see heightened demand from the aerospace industry over the next 20 years, and as a result, it now plans to deliver about 41,000 planes valued at more than $6 trillion. Boeing shares fell fractionally today to $198.33. Home builder Lennar is seeing strong demand for new homes right now. The company reported an increase in sales and said that quarterly orders hit a 10-year high. Earnings took a hit, though, from charges related to a recent acquisition. But overall profit and sales were better than expected. And Lennar shares rose 2% to $53.87. Contessa?
Novartis said its experimental medication for treating vision loss was just as effective in a study trial as rival treatment made by Regeneron Pharmaceuticals. Novartis also said the trial showed patients didn't need to receive as many injections as they would with Regeneron's drug. But Novartis doesn't plan to file for regulatory approval until next year. As a result, Regeneron shares rose 5% to $495.33, while Novartis was up a fraction to $81.60. An enterprise software provider, Red Hat, raised its earnings and sales outlook for the year after reporting earnings and revenue ahead of estimates. The company cited robust global demand and increased commitments from its largest customers. Shares initially took off in after-hours trading, but ended the regular session down marginally to $89.96.
For the first time now, Uber is going to allow drivers to collect tips through the company's smartphone app. The decision is part of a broader effort to improve the company's relationship with its drivers. Drivers have long argued that tips would help compensate for decreased wages. The feature will be available by the end of July.
A lot of grumbling in the newsroom around here when that came through. The heat wave in the Southwest is testing the California power grid. The operator is calling for voluntary electricity conservation in the afternoon and evening. This is the first such alert of this year. Officials say consumers shouldn't use major appliances during those hours and turn off unnecessary lights. In Phoenix, American Airlines canceled some shorter flights that use aircraft that can't operate in temperatures of 118 degrees or higher.
Coming up, is the tax code too long and too old for the modern era? The Speaker of the House thinks so, and he's outlining his plans to change it.
Speaker of the House is optimistic that tax reform can get done this year. Investors, of course, are paying close attention, hoping it would mean robust economic growth. Brian Sullivan talked to Speaker Paul Ryan today at a conference in Washington.
Today, Paul Ryan used a gathering of manufacturing executives in Washington, D.C. to outline his call for broad-based tax reform. In a speech at a conference in Washington, the House Speaker laid out why the U.S. tax code is too long and too old for the modern era, and detailed his plans to simplify it.
I am here to tell you, we are going to get this done in 2017. We have to get this done in 2017. We cannot let this once-in-a-generation moment slip by.
This comes at a crucial time for him and the GOP, as House Republicans work to push through their legislative agenda, racing against the clock of the summer congressional recess, and, of course, trying to get it all done in the shadow of the Russia probe. Ryan remains optimistic that all the attention and headlines will not scuttle their plans.
The Intelligence Committee isn't writing tax reform. The Ways and Means Committee writes tax reform. The Ways and Means Committee is not involved in this investigation. They're busy working on tax reform. So the Intelligence Committee is going to go do their investigation. The special counsel is doing his investigation. The Senate Intelligence Committee is doing theirs. Meanwhile, the Ways and Means Committee, the Finance Committee in the House and the Senate, they're doing tax reform. Just like the Commerce Committee is working on energy reform. Just like the Judiciary Committee is working on immigration reform.
Ryan's plan is similar to the president's in that it proposes to cut the number of tax brackets from 7 down to 3. He also wants to eliminate most itemized deductions, only keeping those for mortgage interest, retirement accounts, and charitable giving, which Ryan says means any federal deductions for state and local taxes paid may have to go.
Let's stop masking profligate governments. Let's stop disguising the inefficiencies of some of these state governments you just mentioned.
That deduction largely taken by those living in high-income, high-tax states like New York and California, states that overwhelmingly vote Democrat. For Nightly Business Report in Washington, D.C., I'm Brian Sullivan.
Meanwhile, Republican senators are racing against the clock on their own on health care, and today they promised to release their bill on Thursday. The goal is to produce and vote on a health care bill before Congress leaves for its traditional July 4th recess. Kayla Tauge reports now on the progress and the sticking points.
After weeks of behind-the-scenes deal-making, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell will take the wraps off health care.
We're going to lay out a discussion draft Thursday morning. You'll be able to take a look at it. I think you've heard from some of my colleagues the likely highlights of it. And I wouldn't want to compare it to the House bill. It'll speak for itself.
The privacy of the negotiations providing fuel for Democrats.
I don't know what's in the bill. Our colleagues who are working in secret right now seem to have a disturbing lack of interest in transparency.
Republicans can only lose 2 votes. Even lawmakers involved in the talks, like Senator Ted Cruz, say there's still a lot of work to do. The party's priorities vary widely. Some, like Cruz, insist on lowering premiums. Others worry most about excluding large numbers of Americans with pre-existing conditions. Lawmakers from states that expanded Medicaid want to make sure cuts to that program won't cause the number of uninsured to skyrocket. The plan reportedly proposes deeper spending cuts to Medicaid, but defers the end of the expansion to 2025. Governors like Colorado's John Hickenlooper have been pressing senators to consider their views.
You know, in the end, the governors are the ones who have to implement this stuff. And certainly the House bill, almost every governor thought it was a terrible idea.
The president previously praised that bill.
This is a great plan.
But has since said privately the Senate's version needs to be more generous.
White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer says the president has been involved in the negotiations with the Senate leadership, but didn't know whether he had seen any portions of the bill just yet. For Nightly Business Report, I'm Kayla Tauche, Washington.
Health care and tax reform are both central to the broader White House agenda. And today, the special congressional election in Georgia is being viewed as a referendum on that agenda. And it's gaining national attention. John Harwood is in Atlanta tonight. So, John, this is the most expensive race, House race in history. Why is there so much money and so much attention?
$51 million so far, Contessa. The reason is we've had some special elections this year, but this is the first one where Democrats had a legitimate shot to win. In fact, this is the kind of district they need to win if they're going to win the House back in 2018. It's very Republican, but a lot of college-educated Republicans, that is Donald Trump's weakest Republican constituency. So money, attention, volunteers have poured in here. Democrats are trying to win with John Ossoff, a young, inexperienced candidate. Republicans have Karen Handel. Turnout's been high today, although we've got a lot of rain this afternoon.
You know, I keep hearing how important this race is between those two candidates right there, John, but I don't hear the issues. What are those issues that could decide the outcome on this?
Well, really, the backdrop bill for this race is Donald Trump. The candidates, Karen Handel doesn't like to talk about Donald Trump, and John Ossoff isn't talking about him that much either, because he doesn't want to inflame Republicans who are disproportionately represented in this district. But what is pushing the money in and what's pushing the enthusiasm and the turnout are feelings about Donald Trump. His approval rating is 35% in this district. 26% of Republicans disapprove of his performance so far. That's higher than the national average. That would be a good sign for Democrats, except there are so many Republicans in this district. Polls overall have been very close right up to the end.
But really, this is one race. If the Republicans do lose this one district, does it really affect the overall Republican agenda?
Well, it could. And that turns on whether or not, if Ossoff wins, for example, if Republicans suddenly become spooked and say, hey, all of our seats are in danger next year, we've got to run away from Donald Trump, and that means running away from his agenda. On the other hand, if Karen Handel can hold this seat, they might be calmed down and be able to say, okay, steady as she goes.
John Harwood in Atlanta. John, thank you. And that's Nightly Business Report for tonight. I'm Contessa Brewer. Thank you for watching.
Good night, Contessa. I'm Bill Griffith. Have a great evening, everybody. We will see you back here again tomorrow.